Before we get into the episode, just a quick heads up that I mentioned the wrong episode number when we get started. That was my mistake when we recorded. And also, you can support the FitCast at patreon.com/thefitcast. Starting at just $1 per episode, you can become a contributor to the show to help keep it going. We're at about 50% of the episode goal now, so please jump on that site. Just starting at $1, you can support the show. Hope you enjoy the episode with Mark Fisher. He is fantastic, and we will catch you next time. Well, welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 305. I am Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have on the show for the first time someone that I met, I want to say 2 years ago now, was the first time we actually had an extended conversation.
I think that's right.
An extended conversation at some Providence, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyways, it's Mark Fisher, and if you haven't checked out Mark's stuff before, I know you've been writing for bodybuilding.com, and you also had it kind of went around the internet a couple weeks ago, or by the time people are listening to this, maybe like a month or two ago, a cool TEDx talk that you and your business partner did on what you're doing in New York. But I wanted to get you on because A, what you're doing in New York is super fascinating, and B, this is just kind of the series of like me wanting to get you're popular. Like you're out there in the fitness industry.
Wow, but, thanks, dude.
But what I'm saying is, like, I'm trying to introduce our audience with the FitCast. Like, we have, like, you know, 15, 20,000 people that listen to the show.
Sure.
Introduce them to people outside the box of the same, you know, 50 or so people that I've been talking to the last couple of years. And selfishly, you know, we only got to talk for a little bit in Providence. And it'll be nice to have a little bit of an extended conversation about what you do and your process and things like that. So thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
So the first thing I want to start off with, and it's what people listened to the last couple episodes with Roger Lawson. The thing that I want to start off with is, how did you get into the whole fitness industry thing? Like, there are so many people out there that get into it because, you know, it's like, yeah, I was out of shape. Like, that was Roger's thing. It's like, yeah, I went to the doctors and I had high cholesterol. So I thought maybe I should get, you know, into some better healthy conditions, get into shape. But what was the, you know, story, or what was the journey for you?
Yeah, you know, man, it seems to me so often, at least for a lot of the men in our field, there's sort of two routes, right? Often you either have the guy who was athletic and for whatever reason wound up in the strength conditioning field because he wanted to stay attached to athletics. The other sort of archetype is the classic, like, skinny dude who started reading Muscle and Fitness, and I'm definitely in the latter. So for me, I was definitely one of those guys that grew up just like absolutely hating my body. I you know, didn't think of myself as a very athletic guy. And in fact, I really wasn't that athletic. And I was like, you know, a buck 35 when I was like, you know, a senior in high school. And yeah, I decided I want to start working out because I, you know, first
Mark,
of all, at the
can
time.
Can I pause for 1 second? I just have an important phone call. I'm sorry. It's
yeah, no worries, brother.
Sorry about that, folks. It was just a work call I had to pick up. So I apologize, Mark, and apologize to people out there for jumping in there, but please continue.
Yeah, so, you know, long are short, right? I hated myself. I hated my body. I started working out hoping I'd be able to put on some muscle. You know, I was, like, reasonably successful at that. And I, throughout college, worked out on and off and got real serious with it right after I graduated college. I moved to New York City. You know, being an actor, there's a lot of pressure to look a certain way. And just for my life, socially, I want to look a certain way. And I started by reading, like a lot of guys, the muscle magazines, right? So I did, like, you know, Body for Life and, you know, read a lot of the EAS stuff. And then I started reading Muscle and Fitness religiously. Oh my gosh, I'm like embarrassed to say it's so long ago now. I guess like 12 years ago.
It's that evolution, man. It's like
those steps
that you take in terms of, like, that is the stuff that's at the grocery store aisle. And then you go a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper.
Yeah, and I, you know, I still look back so warmly on that time because I, at the time, you know, spent many years, I was a passionate like fan of like, I would never compete because like, you know, I'm not the body type for it, but a passionate fan of bodybuilding. And my original fitness information came from, my memory skills are a little bit nuts. So, and I get obsessive about things I like. So when I tell you, I read every Muscle and Fitness, Flex Magazine, Muscle Mag, Iron Man, Reps, Muscular Development, I read like everything for several years. And that was really my introduction to the fitness industry. So around the same time, I was an actor and I needed to, you know, do other stuff here and there to make ends meet, as is often the case. Mm-hmm. And I started informally just training other people just because I was so passionate about it and I loved it. And, you know, I did the things that, you know, most people do, like giving girls body part splits and things. Now I look back, I'm like, hey, she probably didn't need a chest tri day. But, you know, I was doing it for free because I also had the good sense of like, all right, you don't really know what you're doing. Like you can formally give your friends advice, but you're not a professional, you need to qualify that. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wound up at a certain point deciding I really wanted to make a go at it. So I got a job at a New York sports club here in New York City and got certified for NASM. And randomly, although you know, big box gyms are not always known for a lot of education, there really wasn't a lot there. One of the clients, actually, this girl Miriam, I love, I'm still friends with, randomly was like, have you ever heard of the site T-Nation? And I was like, no, what's that? So that's when I started reading T-Nation, and that sort of opened me up to the, you know, whole strength coach, perform better world of a lot of the circles I run in these days. And I started leaving, you know, I still read, I'm still a passionate fan of a lot of the bodybuilding world and culture, but a lot of my fitness information, I'm sure like a lot of people, you know, in the FitCast world is more related to what the best performance enhancer strength coaches are doing, as well as what a lot of rehab-y type of stuff people are doing.
Okay, so I want to take even another step back and talk a little bit about acting. Because for me, I had this dream as a kid. I still have dreams about it today, about being on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And like performing and stuff like that, because it is one of those things that I probably started doing the podcast for, just to, that this is like a way I can kind of like, you know, perform to get out there and to do something. But, when did you start, you know, knowing that you wanted to perform or start getting into to acting?
You know, dude, it's like, I think I wanted to play pretend desperately a lot as a child. Like, I don't think I was the happiest kid, you know, which is like fine, 'cause I'm a real happy adult now. But I think, you know, like many children, I think I was like, there were a lot of things, you know, that really weighed on me as a child. And I think I was so fascinated by the world of pretend and movies and comic books and anything that would sort of, you know, imagine a fancy world outside my own life where I wasn't feeling super secure or, you know, proud of who I was as a person, all those types of things. So I think that's where it started. Yeah, and that's kind of that, you know. So when I was in high school, you know, I was like performing a lot in, like in theater and stuff, because I originally wanted to be a TV film actor. You know, in New Jersey as a 9-year-old, you don't have a lot of opportunities there. So I wound up, that's sort of how I found up doing theater. And weirdly enough, now it feels weird, but it was sort of natural progression, wound up finding out a pretty good singing voice, and I got into musical theater. And then I actually got my BFA in musical theater from Syracuse University, where I actually got very much into dance, which was really weird for me because, again, my perception was, you know, I wasn't athletic, when in retrospect, perhaps it was a matter of depth perception, those types of things, because I actually was quite coordinated. I had a decent amount of mobility, you know, so I actually became a pretty proficient dancer while I was in college. And that wound up, has continued to be very, very helpful for a lot of the work that I do now, not only with dancers, but also with general population, having a wider breadth of background in movement.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with all this stuff, like, I mean, it's all kind of like fitting together together with what you do now.
Sure.
In New York. So for people out there, I just want to, again, take like another step. You're starting to, you know, train people for free. But was there any kind of like event where you're like, all right, now I got it. I found, you know, the information, or I feel like I have the answers for people out there. I'm ready to start doing this as a profession. And like you said, you're also, you know, working as an actor at the time. How did you balance that stuff out? And then, you know, eventually get to the point where, all right, well, I think this fitness thing, you know, is going to be the path that I should take, you know, instead of focusing on acting as much?
You know, I think, again, it was sort of a natural progression. I, throughout my 20s, worked more and more steadily, better jobs. But I always described fitness was the mistress that eventually left my wife for. So even though, my career, was going okay for an actor, I found myself in situations where I'd be doing like a great regional gig and I'd be like, Single Leg Solution came out. I can't wait to watch this over and over. So I found myself in situations where, I was so obsessed with reading everything I could about training. Mm-hmm. And then also, I reached a certain point in life where, I'd reached a certain age where I was like, I'm not as interested in doing out-of-town work anymore. Mm-hmm. I did a national commercial. I did an Allstate commercial. And I started, and then for the first time, it really hit me how much money you can make doing that. And I was like, breaks. So when I got back to the city after, the show I'd been doing in town, I was out of town. I told my talent agents that I really wanted to focus on TV and film and commercial work. And the other thing that was advantageous was at this point, I've been training for a long time. And, I'd been around for a while. So at that point, I was like, all right, additionally, I now have the opportunity to really sort of see if I can really do something substantial with my business. And by that point, felt I had the skill set, and the confidence to be like, I feel like I really know what I'm doing here, which is so much of, honestly, growing a business in sales anyway, just having that confidence. And because I had been doing it for so long, by the time I really started to promote and develop a real business, I felt pretty good about my skill set, particularly working with people for the general population, people working for aesthetics, as well as like dancers that have special needs.
So what time period was this?
Here's what's nuts, dude. That all happened probably the 4-year anniversary of me being like, okay, let's see if I can have like a kind of a real business. Mm-hmm. And then I spent a year slowly growing my training business, and I started doing group classes for the first time, and I created this total body makeover program we call Snatched in 6 Weeks, which was essentially my own reaction to P90X, and knowing that a lot of my clients and people I want to work with were less and less able to afford me as I started to be working more and more per hour. Mm-hmm. And wanting to create a comprehensive program, because my belief, which I still believe, is for most of the general population, if they go all in, balls to the wall for 6 to 8 weeks, I can teach them a lot of what they need to know, right? Mm-hmm. And I think most trainers worth their salt. The reality is what most people need to know is not that complicated. Yeah. So I created this very comprehensive program with daily educational emails, and since then it's expanded. There's a lot more bells and whistles to it, but that program was the thing that changed everything and became, you sort of kind of grew like wildfire. And in New York, particularly the theater community, came kind of its own little phenomenon. So by the time I had done the third round of this, we are now about 3 years ago. What's interesting is this is actually probably right after you and I met at that Perform Better in Rhode Island. And at the time, I was happy with my own business, but I also thought I was only going to be a one-man band. Mm-hmm. Because I had read The E-Myth, and I had read, I was already reading business books voraciously, and I was understandably nervous about doing a real business because I knew that I had a certain skill set doing this thing, and I knew that my particular shtick was this weird stand-up comedian, performance art, motivational speaker, life coach, professor thing that I just wasn't sure I was really ever going to be able to reverse engineer and have anyone else do. So at that time, my plan was really just to grow MFF to be me, a couple sub-trainers, one or two admin assistants, and I saw a very clear path to making a good living doing that, still doing acting when I can fit it in, and, going to Europe on occasion. And, so I saw a good life for myself at that time. And 3 years ago, a little more than 3 years ago, my now business partner, who's my best friend from high school, had been following the way things were blowing up. And he lived in Philadelphia at the time. And he approached me about, what do you think next steps are here? How are you going to grow this into a real business? And I was like, I'm not. That sounds terrible. I'd rather just, do my own thing, build a brand based on myself. And, slowly, over a course of, I think, several weeks of conversation, he kind of won me over to giving this a real try. And for me, I know one of the tipping points was reading a book called Delivering Happiness, mm-hmm. which is the story of Zappos' corporate culture. And as soon as I read books like it was that, there's a book called Peak by Chip Conley, Good Business by Csikszentmihalyi, whose name I would say wrong, who wrote the book Flow. Once I started to understand that creating a business was going to allow me to have an opportunity to drive community and really create the work environment and really, in many ways, like the work family that I always wanted, that's when suddenly that idea became enticing. So that was about 3 years ago as of today. So, what happened is at that point, I'd already hired my first trainer, this guy Kyle Langworth, this amazing, brilliant trainer that I sort of knew. It's so random that we wound up working together because I barely knew him at the time. I sent him an email. I was like, hey, I want to do this weird thing. Do you want to do it? Okay, you're hired. Which is hilarious now because, you know, not only is he inarguably one of the most knowledgeable trainers in the industry. This guy is like a genius, but also one of my best friends. We also brought into the business another best friend of mine, Brian Patrick Murphy, who is another just really special human being, whose dad was like friends with Pavel, was the original RKCs, who was another musical theater actor who we sort of enticed to come into this sort of business that we were going to create. And we got our own space in January of 2012. We opened up officially the Enchanted Ninja Clubhouse of Glory and Dreams, which is what we call our gym. And we've since had three expansions since then. And the full-time team is now up to around 25-ish people. And there's probably around another 50-odd people that are either work-study students or independent contractors or freelancers that help make the MFF rocket ship fly.
That's explosive growth.
It was nuts, dude. It was nuts.
How do you manage that, you know, with the hiring process? Is it just, you know, finding friends and their friends or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. I have a Skype interview with John Goodman in like an hour and a half for his upcoming product about how we did that. And I have to concede the hiring process for me, a lot of it was certainly dumb luck. You know, I like to think that I've had a lot of intuition, particularly because in the beginning, I mean, I really didn't know what I was doing. I really was like, you know, you seem cool. Let's do this. And I got really lucky that it really worked out pretty well. I think one thing that was useful and part of why I think we attracted the right types of people is when Michael and I started MFF, it really was about the values and like the mission and the vision. Like, what do we want to do? Like, you know, what do we think is missing from the fitness industry? What do we want our business to stand for? Who are we as people and what matters to us? And I think we were always very clear about what our values were and what our mission was. And because I believe we were able to communicate it very articulately, we would draw people that saw the world in the same way as we did. And that, you know, I think that a lot of us was the secret. You know, I think since then it's gotten a little more nuanced. I think since then, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people. So I've learned about that as a skill set that you need to develop if you're going to grow particularly quickly. I think I'm also of late, honestly, things have gotten a lot easier, quite frankly, because, you know, I have obviously a lot of, you know, it's interesting because I know, quite frankly, I'm not super well known in the industry at large, but I have a lot of friends that are really, really well known. So because of that, I really have a really great network of people in the industry. So that very often when people meet an amazing, crazy trainer, they send them my way. So for instance, one of my trainers is this girl, Liz Messina, who's friggin' genius. She's Brooklyn born and raised. She went to Springfield for a long time. She's one of Bill Hartman's proteges. Mm-hmm. And she happened to be in town in New York City after she left IFAST, was kind of bummed, didn't know what to do. And she grabbed lunch with Molly Galbraith. Before Molly was in town for Nigar Fanouni and John Romanella's wedding. Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh my God, you have to go meet these people, right? Because like you're a brilliant trainer, you're crazy. And sure enough, she is a brilliant trainer and she's perfect for MFF. So, you know, she, and actually Liz's case was crazy because during the interview, I almost stopped like three questions in and was like, okay, you're hired. Let's just move on to this. Because she was such the perfect balance of such an amazing trainer and so well-educated and so passionate about the field, but so artistic and authentic and ridiculous and such a unique person that it was so obvious to me. She really, you know, was someone who was going to get what we were doing. So yeah, so now these days I'm luckier because I have that wider network and I try to cultivate, you know, one of my like weird like obsessions, I really want to meet like everyone who's a trainer in the world, but particularly in New York City. Partly this is because, you know, I'm essentially always looking for talent. Mm-hmm. And partly because for my own continued development, I'm just a big believer that everyone has parts of the solution, right? I think everyone has pieces to this puzzle that we're all looking to solve, which I would really define as how to create really powerful fitness solutions that really meet people where they're at and are logistically feasible for them and feasible for a business model. And, you know, I'm just like never not fascinated to talk to anyone in our field and find out the various ways they're approaching it and what they know. And, you know, it's like, I really like, I feel like lots of times and, you know, I've spent like a lot of time really just like interviewing people and just like grilling them. Like, what parts of this do you know that I don't have yet? So these days, that's sort of how we've sort of managed the growth.
What do you think drives you to do all this?
It's like, all right, this is like morbid, but like flat out, dude, it's mortality. Flat out. I am.
Like longevity? Like you want to live to 150?
That I don't know that I will, how long I have, frankly. And that's not honestly totally rational. And like, You know, I definitely had, like many people, some intense, you know, life experience when I was younger that I don't need to go into great detail about. But I, you know, weirdly, and it's not rational, right? I can't have a reason for it, have this weird, like constant awareness of my mortality that for me really works for me. Okay. And for a brief period of my life in high school, it did not work for me. And I was not very successful because it was crippling. And at a certain point, you know, and who knows why, you know, I have my theories, which are probably all wrong because of narrative bias, but I somehow was able to flip that and make every day is very meaningful to me, right? So I literally feel like I want to make the maximal positive impact on the world around me, and I'm painfully aware that tomorrow is not promised, right? So I want to spend as much time as I can every day with creating the best possible legacy to make the world better because I was here. And the joy for me of MFF, what I have learned in the past couple of years, is that fundamentally is about other people. And I think in my 20s, I'm not like knocking myself, but it was only about myself because I just had to get my shit together. I had to figure out who I was. I had to work on my garbage. And not that by any means I'm a Buddha. I have my, you know, all my stuff is figured out. Like, I'm, you know, certainly have my perfections like anyone, but I think I did a lot of work on myself throughout my 20s. So by the time I found myself in a position where I was helping run an organization, I was ready for that next step, which is, okay, now knowing myself, how do I meet other people where they're at? How do I speak to people in a way that's going to be meaningful to them? And how can I share with them this sort of, you know, this vision, this thing that, you know, ideally we all want to commit to doing together. And again, it's, you know, the great thing also, I think, about being able to articulate who you are and what you want to do is it's self-selecting. So there's a lot of people that are awesome and amazing that I'm friends with and I love that, you know, for instance, would probably never want to work at MFF. And like, hey, it's no love loss. I get it. We have occasionally a drag queen run through. Sometimes people don't wear pants. You know, it's a weird place. It's not for everyone. But yeah, I think I'm just driven to make the maximal positive impact I can in the time that I have. And for me these days, that is about how do I create conditions to develop other people to be their very best selves so that none of us die with our song inside of us and we all die empty.
So it's kind of the case of wanting to do as much good as possible while you are capable of doing so, right?
Utterly, like 1,000,000%. And also, you know, I think because I do feel like I have a certain skill set for the type of thing that I do. And again, I can tell you like so many things I do poorly that I've had to like get other people to do either for me or I've had to work on. But I do think I seem to have a unique skill set for this type of organizational structure and like leadership and, you know, driving people towards a shared vision that I feel like there's a certain obligation that any of us have. And I feel everyone has an obligation to live out their talents, you know. And I, for me, like I do think that's mine. But I think that my perspective is that the entire universe is counting on everyone to, you know, give us what you've got because everyone has their secrets. Everyone has a part of this puzzle, you know, and that's a very Seth Godin thing he always says, you know, the universe is counting on you, which to me, you know, just gets me burning every time I hear that. I'm like, yes, I want to make the world better today.
All right, well, let's take, I know you didn't want to hit on this too much, but let's take a step back, and I'm willing to be open to theories of what you think caused you to kind of flip. Because there are, I'm sure, I mean, this is the world. There's people out there spinning their wheels and they don't feel like they're going anywhere. They don't know, you know, should I go forward, left, right, back? Like, which way should I go? So was there like a talk that you saw? Was there a person you met or was there a book that you read that made you think, all right, this makes sense to me? Or like it is, like I talked with Roger about this, like it's almost like buying into some philosophy. Like it's something that you are willing to, you know, accept is like, yeah, this makes sense to me and this is the direction I want to go in or something like that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it was a conflagration of a lot of factors. I can't say it was like a particular book per se, or, you know, I will say that another thing that happened 4 years ago, I had always been a very, very voracious reader, okay? And a little over 4 years ago, I remember reading that Alan Cosgrove read 2 books a week and I was like, oh, that's a great idea. I'll read 2 books a week too. I'm just going to do that too. And I started like banging through, you know, Mike Boyle's like, you know, recommended reading on Strength Coach, you know, and again, I had read a lot before then, but this is when I decided, okay, non-negotiable every week, ideally for the rest of my life, I want to read at least 2 books a week. And some of the materials I read around them. One of them, you know, weirdly enough, honestly, was Brian Tracy's Goals, which, you know, is, you know, kind of corny in some moments, quite honestly. But for me, what it did was it forced me to develop a process of goal setting where I became very clear about what I wanted my life to be and what I wanted my impact on the world around me to be. And then I would get so excited about that that for me, it's allowed me to link a lot of the daily stuff that other people might not enjoy, because I never lose sight of the fact that when a ninja sends me an email sad about something, that, you know, a quick, thorough, and helpful response is going to move me forward to what that 10-year plan is. Okay, so for me, I feel like I've linked a lot of like the crap work that people are not always interested in, the detail work, into that bigger picture. Now, I will say I believe that is probably a quirk of the way I am set up. I do think there's different temperaments. I think some people are great at the big picture stuff, but sometimes struggle to live in the day-to-day and actually do daily work. I think other people are perhaps better at process and system and detail orientation, but have a hard time looking up above their laptop to really see where is this leading to? What is the end game that I'm doing? So there's this great Jim Rohn quote, right? If you see someone building a house, they're just sort of putting bricks random places, but they don't really have a blueprint. You know, that's like, you know, you put them in a little white room. That's less than ideal. Mm-hmm. So, and it's very Stephen Covey, right? It's begin with the end in mind, you know?
Yeah, you're reading.
Yeah, man, I'm a lunatic. I'm a lunatic. And I also say this is a random thing. Lately, I've been thinking that not everybody should do that. It's something I've recently been meditating on. It's one of those things, again, that, you know, you always have to be careful, I think, in life when you see things that work for you, because not everything, I think very few things, honestly, are probably universal, mm-hmm. right? A lot of people don't like that sort of staid Jim Rohn style, old school goal setting. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it works. You know, and you almost can like look at the industry and like find the people that like, you know, and again, I'm a fan of everyone, right? So like you look at people and you're like, okay, like Tom Finuto, like that really works for him, man. Like he, that is working for him. Like Craig Ballantyne, absolutely works. Like that time management stuff, those guys are nailing it with this. Mm-hmm. And I would say that for me, you know, I've had a similar journey. But I will say that, you know, I don't know that that's everyone's journey. I don't know that like the systems that I've used are always going to be effective for people. I think we can always learn things from other people, but you know, everyone is different. And reading, you know, two books a week for me, I know has been useful. I think for other people, it can sort of lead you down a rabbit hole, because the more knowledge you have, you know, sometimes it cannot serve you, right? And something I was thinking about, this is really weird, I was thinking about today about like, you know, you have to have the stability to own extreme mobility, right? Hypermobility in a vacuum is inherently clinically dysfunctional. However, if you have the stability to, you know, own that end range of motion, which mm-hmm. is why I find Andrew Espina and the FRC stuff so fascinating, then it's actually awesome. Right. And I've often, you know, lately been thinking like there's a certain amount of intellectual firepower and knowledge that I would qualify as mobility, that if it's not matched by stability / emotional intelligence, then you're going to run into issues. And it's actually almost more dangerous to have incredible intellectual firepower but lack, you know, self-awareness and self-mastery and, you know, being able to pick up on how you're affecting other people and et cetera.
Are you able to shut it off? Like shut this, you know, always like constant thirst for information or, you know, work.
Do you
go on vacation?
Yeah, I totally do. I totally do. And, you know, I can't say I ever really like turned off that I stopped thinking about it, but I do vary what that work is. Okay. So for me, what's been sort of useful is, you know, listen, it's not that I'm not thinking about MFF when I'm traveling, but you know, I'm lucky because I live the life that I do. I get to, you know, travel like a lot. Like it's rare, you know, and I go to a lot of seminars. A lot of it's for work, but like, you know, I mean, I take like as many vacations as I can in a year. You know, I try to get out of town at least once a month. And I'm also fortunate. I have an amazing girlfriend who's been very helpful in centering for me, because admittedly it was more of a problem before I had her, frankly, because I would, you know, could so get lost in that rabbit hole. So we all need accountability in life. Listen, that's one of my downsides. And, you know, I think in relationships and organizations, we give each other what we lack. And it seems to be one of the things I value so much about my girlfriend, who's so awesome, is she's so good at like it intuitively helping me like turn off and watch TV and just shut up. Which, you know, it's not even like a manipulative thing or just like something about her. She draws that part of me out that I need, I think, to balance, you know, my go-getter. So I do think that I do a pretty good job of turning off. You know, I probably don't do as much as many people do, but, you know, I will say it right now, I'm incredibly satisfied with this balance. And because I rarely find myself burning out, you know, I feel like it works for me, right? And if I never burned out, that actually would almost be more of a concern, because that would make me consider like, okay, well, am I really being honest here? Am I like grinding on gas and I just don't know it? Because I once every like 3 months, I'll have like a Thursday night towards the end of the week where I'll have a little cry, right? Where like I just like, I did too much that week. I put too much on my plate. And then, you know, I do feel like I'm pretty good at learning my mistakes. So I will adjust things and I'll have a talk with, I have a, you know, an amazing assistant I work with, does a lot of my scheduling for me. And, you know, I'm very regimented about my time management. So we'll know that, like, you know, that week I had too many meetings. I didn't have enough personal time. I also take a break in the middle of the day every day, which is a little bit weird, because for me, I know I'm most effective in the mornings. So I will tend to do most of like my hardest, like brain work and my highest profile, my highest mission critical stuff from like 7 to 10 or 11. Then I have an hour or two to have a meeting or two, just so I'm getting like a little bit losing gas. Then depending on the day, I'll take like a 3 to 4 hour block where I will cook breakfast. I will usually either watch a YouTube or listen to an audiobook about something I'm working on, some sort of continuing education thing. You know, I'll catch up on emails. I'll do things that aren't like major brain stuff. I'll take either, at least, if not a full nap, I'll at least go in my room. And I'm lucky, again, I live in the same building that I work in. And I'll just turn off lights and just like literally do nothing for 30 minutes. I'll just lie there. If I feel like reading, I might. If I take a nap, but I literally just like stop. Then I'll get up and I'll go work out. And I'll take that time for myself just to work out. And then I essentially have what feels like another work day. Because at this point, now I'm pretty refreshed. Now we're at 4. You know, now it's game time again. Now maybe I'm teaching classes. I'm doing meetings. Then I save paperwork and non-brain intensive stuff towards the end of the day. And by that point, you know, depending on the day, you know, come, you know, usually it's never really earlier than 8:30. Sometimes it's not till 10 when I get real busy. I start shutting that on down. And I'm also very regimented about sleep. I'm like, I rarely get less than 7.5 hours. I'm like a lunatic about that. Yeah.
Man, that's good living.
You know, and I'll tell you the other thing about that, why that I don't know that approach is going to work for everyone. I got lucky in my relationships because my girlfriend's a Broadway actress. So in addition to, first of all, again, being like the most supportive and like understanding and like sweet and amazing girl in the world, her work schedule means that, you know, if I'm working during the day, it's bonus because we can like hang out and she can sit on the couch with me while I work because I'm essentially working from home, right? Then she goes and does her show. So there's no pressure for me to be done at 6, even if I start working at 7 that day. I can easily work till 9 and I've got time for myself to unwind and relax a little bit so we can, you know, have some quality time together when she gets home at the end of the evening.
I can't believe you still have a landline.
I know. Well, it's actually the business. It's MFFs.
Oh, fair
which
enough.
And it's like we have like a backup, so phones are blowing up downstairs. Or if somebody wants to use the landline for MFF, they can use it. MFF, we call it the Ninja Treehouse. So the third floor of MFF is where my business partner and my girlfriend and his boyfriend all live together. And for me, that's awesome. I don't recommend that for most people. For me, it works amazing. And then we're lucky because it's a really nice place in New York City, which is a very expensive place to live because MFF, you know, it's partially our office. So during the day, it's great because it's me, Michael, our assistant, and our bookkeeper all work up here. And then we have other office space elsewhere for our general manager and the trainers and other office people to do their work.
Very cool. All right. And then, I mean, the schedule setup is kind of perfect for people out there who aren't familiar with like the day to day of a health club or a fitness facility or whatever. Like the time's usually dead in between like 11 and like 3 or 4. And even with us at Boyle's, like it's dead from like noon to 2.
Totally.
There's no one in there. It's just staff lifting and stuff like that.
Yeah. And ours is, you know, it's interesting too, because weirdly my day to day now is a little bit detached from MFF's sort of adventures because, you know, MFF, now we've got 4 spaces that are, you know, going like all day long. We do have that mid-afternoon break, but the reality is since, you know, I'm not doing most of the teaching these days, you know, we have like a small army of people that are, you know, doing a lot of the day-to-day stuff. So for me, I'm lucky because my schedule isn't like as reliant on MFF's like hourly stuff. My schedule is dependent on our seasonal busyness, right? Based on if we're doing our total body makeover program, which I mentioned in the beginning of the program, you know, that's like epic for us because that's a very time intensive program. We also have a snatched 2, so we have an advanced curriculum. So we'll have 160 odd people doing this very intensive 6-week, you know, total body makeover, which, you know, includes lots of coaching and you know, a lot, the whole team has to do like a lot of work to support that many people en masse going through a very intensive fitness experience that for a lot of people becomes a very intensive like life experience, right? Because I think, you know, those of us in the field, one of the things we all love about it, right, is like, I believe through teaching people about nutrition and fitness, you're teaching them about their own volition, right? You're showing that there are things you can do. You are not an effect of the universe. You, in fact, have more power than oftentimes we, I think, are led to believe, right? And I do believe that all of us do that. Again, no one's we all give our power away, right? We give it to our, like, our mom and our ex-husband and, like, our boss and the bitch who said you look fat in those jeans, right? And I think that a lot of the work that we get to do, hopefully as fitness professionals, is give people a way to take that power back through fitness and nutrition. And I think that becomes a doorway to understanding their own power in all realms of their life, right? So the nature of Snatched is like, you know, it gets like deep for a lot of people, right? Not everyone, like some people totally like, you know, laugh at funny jokes and they lose 5 pounds and, you know, they, you know, go out to the bar and get laid and, you know, that's cool too. But I know that for a lot of people, you know, you start having to deal with, okay, why is it that I keep going? Why is it that I need this donut so bad right now, you know? Or what is it that's stopping me from, you know, taking this behavior that I know is going to lead me to get to my goals? And I know that, you know, that's partly why we, several people on our team have life coaching certifications, and we are very much interested in that part of the process. Because the other thing I think people in the fitness industry, we all know, it's not really the knowledge gap. You know, in the beginning, it's the knowledge gap. For sure, people don't usually know what they're doing. But again, you know, in 6 weeks, most people, you can teach them what they need to know for the general population, right? They don't need more complexity. They don't need carb cycling. They don't need, you know, Smolov squat cycles. Yeah. What the general population needs is, you know, a space to bring awareness to themselves and, you know, figure out what it is that they're missing, you know? And very often we know that that's social support. And I think that's part of the secret sauce here is because we're so driven by community, you know, people have, you know, that, you know, none of us get through this world alone, right? That people have that built-in community of people to like give a shit about them and, you know if they're not there and are going to hold them accountable.
And I mean, if people have been listening to the show for a while, this is like the thing that I am most interested in today is the, not necessarily like, all right, what program do I need to get my quads huge for the summer?
Sure.
I want to know, like, why the hell, even if we have the information, why aren't we acting on it? Like, what is that thing that's still causing us to, like, I run on this all the time. Like, sometimes, like, you have a rough day or you have a long day at work, like, you get some shitty emails or something like that. I'm like, man, that pizza place on the way home looks real good.
Sure, man.
I'm just going to grab a pizza, I'm going to walk my dog, and then I'm going to drink a beer and go to sleep.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny, too, because, you know, that's, you know, you're looking at, there's a great book called Willpower, this guy named Roy Baumeister, who's done a lot of the incredible research into willpower. And, you know, it's interesting that very often one of the things that we've seen seems to be the case, you know, lack of glycogen in the brain is correlated with loss of willpower, which is, you know, perhaps one of the reasons why it's so challenging to, you know, so challenging to maintain your willpower while on a diet, maybe, right? And this, you know, it all gets sort of confusing. You know, it's interesting, I read an amazing book recently called Anti-Fragility, by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, I believe his name is. And, you know, he's very funny, very contrarian. And like one of his things, you know, he's like kind of on the I think Taubesian Lustig train of like, don't have sugar of any kind. Like, you know, his whole thing was like, you can't, those studies don't actually matter because those people usually ate carbs. And the solution is we just shouldn't eat carbs and sugar. That's, you know, to let you know, to betray my sort of affiliation there, I tend to be more of an Alan Aragonian. Is someone I consider a mentor. So that's not my personal jam, but anyway,
is that a well-used term for Alan?
Not really, but I do think there's Alan Aragonians. There's like the Dick Talents for photography, totally. Joy Victoria, like his little, like, you know, I don't want to say we're his minions, but, you know, people, you know, because, you know, and Alan, you know, is a guy that like I'm such a fan of, and those are, you know, the dudes I love most, you know, and again, like I'm like kind of annoying because I love everyone. I'm such a Pollyanna. But the thing that I love about like Alan and like Brad Schoenfeld and, you know, a lot of those evidence-based guys, which I know I have other friends, right, that like are not in the evidence-based world because they prefer more mechanistic, you know, explanations of why things happen, and you know, the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence, and I totally get that. I think that's a very valid, you know, thing to be mindful of. But the thing I love about those guys are, you know, I really respect when people are willing to change their mind when the facts change. And I think the one of the things that the joy of the evidence-based crew is, you know, people change their minds. You know, if shit comes out, like, you know, you look at a guy like John Fast, another dude I've always been a big fan of, like, you know, and like, yeah, he's going to hold everyone to task and he'll be like, FMS doesn't have research, and, you know, and like, but, you know, we need those guys, you know. And for me, like, again, I always think of like systems as like an organism. It's like, we need all those voices. Like, that's why I like everybody, because I think everyone has a part to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, sure.
And no doubt there's personal bias. Alan, I think, is like funny, right? And he was the guy that like 4 years ago when I wrote, I was like, hey, Alan, I just started this blog. Listen, I hope it's okay. I quoted you in this thing. You know, and he like subscribed to my newsletter on his personal like Gmail. I was like, oh my God. So that's part of it too. But I also just think he's cool. So
it's so funny today. Like for me, it's like, man, I do this like video game podcast on the side. And when I have like these video game developers like start following me on Twitter, I'm like, oh my God, I played his game. And he's like, cares enough to see that I am talking about dumb stuff on Twitter. It's kind of the same thing. All right. No, so I'm buying books right now. Like, you have me buying books, which is usually the sign of a really good interview when I'm on audible.com looking for books.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's Anti-Fragile.
Anti-Fragile, yeah. And that was, I got to give credit to Bill Hartman was the guy that recommended and got me that book. And I, at first, I was like, oh man, this is a big book. But
yeah,
honestly,
16 hour audio book, by the way.
But I'll tell you what, this is like, and again, I'm a loser, so don't take anything by this. Honestly, I was like emotional at the end of that book. For me, that was the closest to like Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings that I felt about a nonfiction type of book. And here's other qualifications. This guy is a madman. He's a lunatic. This is a guy who gets like in fights and conferences because he just gets so mad at people. But at the same time, and I furthermore still think he goes too far with most of his things. I don't agree with him on everything by any means, but I just think he's so smart. And, you know, just a very important voice, you know, and he's contrarian, but not for the sake of being contrarian. I think he's a lot of valid things. You know, again, for me, he goes too far very often. He falls a little bit too in extremism. But, you know, I just think he's really made me rethink a lot of stuff, you know, because his whole perspective on the, you know, nutrition world, which I was like, okay, you know, because, all right, I tend to be like, you know, like sort of live in evidence-based land, right? Mm-hmm. So there, you know, we're like, you know, it is true the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence. However, if you are to say that aspartame is carcinogenic, I have to hold you to task and say, well, you can't really say that, okay? Because you don't really, you know, and again, maybe listeners can correct me. To my understanding, we don't have an identified mechanism whereby aspartame is going to cause cancer. And yeah, I'm pretty sure we don't have any evidence to actually prove that that's happened, okay? So it is, I think, bizarre to say that it's going to do that. And what I will concede, I always concede my work with ninjas. However, I think it's appropriate for you to have intuition and say, for me, I do not believe that, you know, artificial sweeteners are natural, so I don't want them. I think that's mm-hmm. fine. I think we run into issues when we start telling other people how to live their life based on our intuition. And I think that is a major issue and one of the major sources, quite frankly, of human strife among all of society. And Tlaib, interestingly enough, I think, you know, his counterargument against that, which I was like, is he believes in heuristics, right, or rules of thumb. His perspective is that anything is natural, the burden of evidence is on us to prove that it's bad for you, right? Like, okay, so marijuana, you have to prove it's bad for you because it exists, right? Mother Nature gave us marijuana, right? It's a natural thing. However, the burden of proof for artificial sweetener is on us to prove that it's safe, because we should presume that non-safe things are, by definition, are more likely to cause a problem, right? And, you know, I don't know that I would go so far as to say that, you know, like I do believe, because my perspective is the human body, it seems, and again, this is intuition, right? I can't, you know, people can disagree with me. It seems reasonable to believe the human body is adaptable enough to deal with like moderate doses of just about anything, right? You could probably, like, it's unlikely to be a moderate like crack cocaine user, but like you could probably moderately do crack cocaine, you know, several times a year and probably live a reasonably-ish healthy life. Again, I wouldn't probably recommend it. So, you know, I think within reason, I think, you know, and I just don't know what moderation is. And for mm-hmm. me, you know, as a fitness professional with people, you know, I don't know. Cause yeah, my go-to thing is like moderate diet soda is probably not a big deal, but I, you know, is moderate like once a week? Is it, you know, three times a week? Is it, you know, every day sounds like it's on the high side, but why does that even sound on the high side? You know, like, so I'm just, you know, very aware at all times that most of what I think is like this weird intuition that's not always based in reality, which, you know, I think is hard in the fitness industry. And I think it's harder, you know, the more people want your opinion to hold on to that thread. So something that Mike Boyle said a long time ago, which I think is so important for fitness professionals always to keep in mind, is half of what we know is wrong. We don't know what half. Okay, and if you look at, you know, I think a great example is right now, you know, 3 years ago, everyone's like, their brains were exploding about doing crunches and sit-ups, which on balance, I think we still think is probably not a good choice for most people most of the time. However, now with the advent of PRI, we're seeing, you know, the importance of people getting into flexion and, you know, obviously, you know, PRI puts forth that if you don't have the ability, if you're always in this sort of extension-based tone, your sympathetic nervous system is going through the roof. You know, and again, that makes sense to me. But at this point, I think we all owe it to each other to have a constant healthy skepticism of each other and of ourselves. Because the reality is, you look at the smartest people in the industry right now, you know, we need to concede that like 20 to 50% of what they're saying is totally wrong. It's totally, totally wrong, right? Like at least probably 20, 50% of what I believe to be the case right now, I know I'm going to be wrong about. Mm-hmm. Right, we know we're going to look back at, you know, I was like joking with Liz Messina about this, and you know, this is like, you know, no disrespect for anyone's fault, like, because you know, there's no one I love more in the world than Eric Cressy, Mike Roberts, and Bill Hartman. But she was like laughing about how if you go into assess and correct, you look at the rib cage alignment that everyone's in compared to, you know, what perhaps more progressive understanding of the appropriate position that canister is. Whoa, boy, you know, that's like, you know, that was only a few years ago that we were saying, like, definitely do this thing. So that's why I think it's important, you know, when we have our current belief systems, you always want to leave that door open a crack, because, like, I don't know anything, man, right? Listen, there's nothing that I believe that I couldn't find out. I was like, well, okay, well, I guess, you know, actually, we should be doing lots of crunches. Turns out that doing tons of crunches, like, you know, stops, like, brain cancer, right? Unlikely, yeah. But, you know.
All right. I mean, we're just barely scratching the surface, but we're out of time. So what we're going to do is we'll get you back next episode. We'll get you back. Hopefully we can schedule something and talk again. But for people out there that want to check out your stuff, is the best place just markfisherfitness.com? Do you have still like a personal blog going on?
Yeah, you know, markfisherfitness.com is MFF's home. I write a business blog that I'm like very erratically because it's my pet project, businessforunicorns.com. Cool. And people can always find me at mfisherfitness on Twitter. Obviously, you can find me on Facebook. And I still answer every email at mark@markfisherfitness.com. And I like making friends, so never be shy about sending me an email.
Send pics.
Yeah, send me pics. Send me funny comments.
Yeah, pictures. Totally. Pictures of puppies are always
yeah,
welcome.
Yeah, they just relax you.
Totally.
That's parasympathetic as fuck.
For people out there, don't forget to support the FitCast. If you enjoy what we're doing, please go to thefitcast.com, click on that donation tab on the left-hand side, and like Molly put it so well, if you think there is value to this content and you're in the position to do so, please help support the show going forward. And as always, jump on iTunes, submit a review on there. That is another way to support the show. And Mark, we'll be back with you next week. And again, we'll schedule something. We'll make sure we do another one real soon.
Looking forward.